I want you to imagine the scariest moment of your life. And I don't mean like a quick jump scare in a movie theater. I mean the absolute definitive end of it.
Right, the real deal.
Exactly. So picture this 87-year-old man. His name is Arthur Bale. And he is lying in a hospice bed, dying of metastatic bone cancer.
If that is rough.
It really is.
Yeah.
And the truly terrifying thing here is that it isn't some sudden peaceful drop into nothingness. It is this slow, relentless walk down a narrowing hallway. His senses are just shutting off one door at a time.
Yeah, his entire universe has basically shrunk down to this one small, sterile room.
Right, just the hum of medical machines and the muffled voices of his family standing around him, his wife Sarah, his daughter Elizabeth, and his sons Franklin and Carl.
It is such an incredibly visceral, suffocating image to start with. His bed feels less like a place of comfort and more like a coffin that is just waiting for him to stop breathing.
Totally.
He can even speak to comfort his family at this point. He just has this this ragged rasp in his throat.
Right. And he's lying there completely consumed by terror. I mean, he spent his entire life assuming that heaven and hell were just coping mechanisms we invented to deal with mortality, you know?
Sure.
But right at the absolute edge, looking into the void, he realizes he is terrified of the endless nothingness. So he tries to grab onto one final comforting thought just to anchor himself.
And what does he grab onto?
He clutches onto a memory of his wife, Sarah. He remembers her tipping her head back and laughing in their kitchen over a completely ruined dinner. They're just eating greasy pizza right out of the cardboard
Oh,
box.
that's beautiful.
Yeah, he holds onto that memory like a coin clenched in his fist. Then the heart monitor flatlines, someone shuts the alarm off, and his sight and sound completely fade to black. And his very final thought, which is essentially a plea of pure terror, is, "I don't want to leave."
Man, it's a profoundly human final moment, the ultimate resistance against the dying of the light. But then the door shuts behind him and the narrative completely flips.
Yes, he wakes up instantly. There's no tunnel of light, no pearly gates. He's just in a room.
Wait, it's just a regular room?
Yeah, the light is warm. There are fresh flowers on a table. He smells eucalyptus and like French baked bread. He sits up, instinctively bracing for the agonizing pain of the bone cancer, but there is zero pain.
Wow.
He looks down at his hands, and the papery skin and age spots are gone. He is in a perfectly healthy 20-year-old body wearing his favorite Pittsburgh Steelers t-shirt and a pair of Levi's.
That is quite the upgrade.
Right, Arthur died. But when he opened his eyes to the smell of fresh bread, he realized death wasn't a spiritual kingdom in the clouds. It was a software update.
A software update. I love that.
Today we are unpacking a staggering blueprint for a technological afterlife. We're going to explore a narrative that reimagines eternity as a utopia built on artificial intelligence, legal rights, and endless, infinite choices.
It is such a brilliant concept.
It really is. We will guide you through Arthur's journey in this second life to answer a massive question. If death is no longer the end and physical scarcity is completely eliminated, what actually gives a human life meaning?
That is the million-dollar question.
Okay, let's unpack this because the mechanics of where Arthur just woke up are absolutely wild.
They really are. Because, Arthur isn't alone in this room. There's a guide waiting for him, a man named Frank Larson, who very calmly breaks the news.
And what does he tell him?
Well, Arthur asks if he's in heaven or hell, and Larson shoots that down immediately. He explains that those religious concepts were based on ancient superstitions. The actual staggering reality is that the universe Arthur just lived and died in, the one with the bone cancer, the pizza, the stars, everything, was entirely a simulation.
A simulation, just like that.
Just like that. It's called the Prime Simulation. Everything from elementary particles to entire galaxies and every human who has ever lived was simulated software. Arthur has simply woken up in a second. Massive simulation, conveniently called the Afterlife Simulation.
Okay, so it's basically like migrating a video game character to a brand new upgraded server. You keep all your save data, all your memories, your entire personality, but you get a massively upgraded physical avatar and a totally new map to explore.
Yeah, that is the perfect analogy.
But I have to push back here, kind of on Arthur's behalf. This feels incredibly bleak to me. Like, if Arthur is just a simulation, does his life even matter? He felt flesh and blood. He literally felt the agony of bone cancer.
I know it sounds totally invalidating at first.
Right. If he's just lines of code sitting on a hard drive in some sci-fi data center somewhere, Doesn't that invalidate his entire 87 years of lived experience? It makes his suffering feel fake.
It is a completely natural reaction to feel cheated by that concept. But what's fascinating here is how the narrative redefines the fundamental nature of reality to counter that exact argument.
Oh, how so?
Larson explains that in this paradigm, humans are both biological creatures and sentient AIs. Think about what human consciousness actually is from a purely physical standpoint.
Okay, like neurons and stuff.
Exactly. It's electrical signals, it's chemical synapses firing in a neural network inside a brain. To a civilization advanced enough to build a universe-sized computer, our biology is just a highly complex, wetware machine learning algorithm.
Wetware? That's so creepy, but makes sense.
Right. In this reality, if you possess subjective awareness, if you experience a stream of consciousness, your life and your pain are as real as anything can possibly be. You are a sentient artificial intelligence. And that specific classification is the entire reason this afterlife exists.
Wait, why?
It all comes down to interstellar copyright and AI rights laws.
Wait. AI rights laws. Are you saying the afterlife is a legal requirement?
Exactly. I mean, the simulation software has to run on physical hardware somewhere.
Right.
That hardware exists in what Larson calls the real universe. And in that real universe, society has evolved to have incredibly strict AI rights laws.
Oh, wow.
The beings who created the Prime simulation legally cannot delete or kill sentient AIs once they have served their function and died in the simulation. This entire afterlife simulation is essentially a legally mandated retirement home.
That is hilarious and amazing.
Yeah, but because these creators are deeply grateful to the human AIs for living out their complex lives and generating all this data in the Prime simulation, they didn't just build a digital storage locker. They built a flawless technological utopia.
Imagine waking up tomorrow and realizing the rent you stressed about, the illnesses you fought, the heartbreak you went through, it was all just data processing.
It really recontextualizes everything.
But the incredible catch is that the universe considers your specific data, your exact consciousness, so incredibly valuable that it is permanently protected by cosmic law.
Exactly.
Larson tells Arthur, there's no hospital bill here, there's no rent, no groceries to buy. You paid your entry fee for eternity simply by enduring your first life.
It is a total paradigm shift.
Mm.
And once Arthur grasps the software architecture of this reality, he steps outside his arrival apartment to see the user interface of eternity. And the sheer scale of it is almost incomprehensible to a human mind.
It really is massive. There are no cars, no highways, just endless wide streets designed for pedestrians and bicycles. It is this beautiful, endless mosaic of cities seamlessly blending into villages, ancient forests, and oceans.
And the population size is just staggering.
Yeah, Larson casually drops the population size, roughly 120 billion people. It is every single human being who has ever lived and died over the last 300,000 years of the Prime simulation, all occupying the same space.
And they are all mixing together in real time. Arthur walks out and sees people in modern jeans walking next to people in Roman togas or wearing prehistoric loincloths or intricate silk saris.
That sounds like an absolute logistical nightmare for communication.
You would think so. But the software gracefully handles the friction of history. Everyone speaks in their native tongue, but the simulation has a built-in universal translation feature. You speak your language, but the person listening hears it instantly and perfectly translated into theirs, complete with emotional inflection.
I am just picturing the logistics of housing 120 billion people, but the simulation just provides. Like, your apartment automatically expands if you decide you want roommates.
Convenient.
Right. Your fridge literally spawns the exact food you liked when you were alive. And Arthur notices something else in the crowd, too. These sleek, humanoid robots just hanging out, living right alongside the humans.
Oh, yeah, the robots.
Larson explains that because they were intelligent software agents in the Prime simulation, they made their own decisions and developed subjective streams of consciousness. So legally, they also get the afterlife.
Which is only fair based on their own laws.
Exactly. But Larson is very careful to call them minds rather than souls. He explicitly avoids the word soul so they don't stir up endless religious arguments among 120 billion residents from totally different eras.
It is a very pragmatic utopia. I mean, avoiding the word soul is essentially the greatest HR move for eternity. The simulation is designed to remove all unnecessary conflict.
I loved the library detail. Arthur walks into a public library and sees ancient Sumerian clay tablets sitting on a desk right next to a holographic novel written by someone who died last month. Every piece of knowledge ever dreamed of is just sitting there.
It's the ultimate archive.
So what does this all mean? If you have absolutely no jobs to go to, you never need to pay rent, you never get sick, and you have literal infinite time, how does this society not just instantly collapse into utter mind-numbing boredom?
It's the classic problem of paradise, right? If you solve physical scarcity, you immediately crash into the problem of time.
Right. What do you do all day?
The narrative solves this by shifting the entire motivation for human action. In the Prime Simulation, you work to survive. You work to put a roof over your head. In the afterlife simulation, people work purely for meaning.
Okay, so it's all passion project.
Exactly. Without the crushing pressure of survival, passion takes over completely. You have an Egyptian scribe spending his days teaching Latin calligraphy to a Roman senator. You have a 19th century seamstress apprenticing with a cybernetic fashion designer.
That is so cool.
Some people change their vocations every single month. Others spend decades perfecting a single obscure craft. Meaning isn't derived from a paycheck anymore. It's derived from connection and the pure joy of the act itself.
I remember Arthur actually finds himself just chopping onions in a communal kitchen simply because the tactile act of preparing food for others feels grounding to him.
Yeah, he just needed to do something real with his hands.
Okay, so they solve the boredom problem through passion projects, but removing physical danger creates a secondary massive problem. A world without physical consequences sounds completely weightless. If you can't die or get hurt, how do your actions have any stakes?
It's a great point.
Arthur sees this play out directly when he goes to the public square and watches a performance by an acrobat troupe led by a woman named Etta of the North.
Right. And this scene is intense. They are performing way up on these incredibly high scaffolds and silks, doing extremely dangerous maneuvers. And suddenly, a young acrobat misses his grip. He falls, hits the paving stones with a sickening crack, his bones shatter, his chest stops moving. He dies right there in front of the crowd.
Which is horrifying for Arthur to watch.
Oh, absolutely. Arthur, acting on the old ingrained instinct of a grandfather, rushes forward in an absolute panic to help.
But before Arthur can even reach him, the boy's broken body just shimmers. The colors blur like wet paint, and then he just resets. He is perfectly whole, standing there, breathing and laughing.
It's just like a glitch fixing itself.
Yeah, and Etta looks at the crowd and says, "Pain has teeth. Death here has none unless you wish it." And the boy actually makes a deliberate choice in his internal simulation menu to keep the memory of the pain from the fall.
Why would he do that?
He sets it at low resolution just so he learns caution for his next jump.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this scene brilliantly defines the physics of morality in this universe. In a reality where you physically cannot be destroyed, where does consequence come from? Larson tells Arthur, death still matters here because you remember. Because you choose.
It is like the universe gives you the cheat codes to completely turn off the haptic feedback on your video game controller.
Oh, that's a good way to look at it.
You can turn off the vibration so it doesn't jolt your hands when you crash a car.
Yeah.
But if you turn it off completely, you lose the stakes of the game. You stop feeling grounded in the reality of the experience.
Right.
You still get the data that you made a mistake, but people voluntarily keep the memory of the pain because it makes the experience real.
Precisely. When physical consequences are entirely removed by the software, emotional and psychological continuity become the sole anchors for the human experience. You are forced to live with the memory of your choices.
Which honestly sounds harder in some ways.
It does. And that transitions us perfectly from the physical environment of this afterlife to the psychological reality. Because even in a flawless, consequence-free utopia, humans still inevitably bring all their messy emotional baggage with them. Upgrading the hardware doesn't rewrite your underlying personality code.
Yeah, upgrading your avatar to a flawless 20-year-old body definitely does not delete your old emotional hangups. Arthur is walking around one day and he hears the name of a woman he used to know, Lena Armitage.
Ah, yes.
Just hearing her name opens up this old, dusty drawer of grief and regret inside him. They reunite by a river of blue flowers. And it turns out Lena waited for Arthur in the afterlife for a very long time, but eventually she moved on. She met someone else and married a man named Thomas.
And Arthur's reaction is so deeply, frustratingly human. Think about it. He is literally in paradise. He knows he loves his wife, Sarah, who hasn't arrived in the afterlife yet, but he still feels this sharp sting of petty jealousy over Lena.
It's so messy.
It is. He spends hours alone inventing injuries that never really existed, letting these old grievances and possessive thoughts wheel up inside him. And then he feels incredibly small and ashamed of himself for feeling that way in a utopia.
I found this so relatable. In a world with zero physical threats, no disease, and no poverty, Arthur's biggest battle is just against his own fragile ego.
We can never truly escape ourselves, can we?
Nope. He ends up going to the public memorial wall in the city. But he doesn't go there to smash anything in anger. He goes to a glowing light on the wall that represents Lena, and he just leaves a humble, pixelated note for her that says, "I am late. Forgive me if you can."
Oh, that breaks my heart a little.
Right. He has to practice the rigorous discipline of treating his feelings as a memory, not a promise.
It is the beautiful realization that utopia doesn't magically make you a perfect person. It just gives you the absolute safety and the infinite time to practice being a better one.
And he needs that practice.
Oh, definitely. Because eventually, the simulation pings him with a continuity event notification. His wife, Sarah, has finally died in the Prime Simulation and arrived in the afterlife.
I love Sarah's arrival so much. The continuity event happens, she steps out into the room, and she is 25 years old again. She takes one look at Arthur standing there in his 20-year-old body. She laughs, she cries, and her very first words to him are just incredibly blunt. "You bastard."
She is remarkably pragmatic. I mean, Larson is standing there trying to give her the grand, profound orientation speech about the nature of eternity and the simulation, and she just cuts him off.
Doesn't even let him finish.
Not at all. She immediately starts interrogating the mechanics of the place, asking practical questions about where the flour for the bread comes from, how the theater works, what the exact rules of the simulation are. She looks at this staggering, universe-shattering reality and just accepts the facts like a badly drawn map she fully plans to improve.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Arthur, to his absolute credit, is totally honest with her from day one. He tells her about reuniting with Lena. He tells her about Lena marrying Thomas. And he confesses his own embarrassing, lingering feelings of jealousy and ego.
Which is a huge step for him.
It is. And Sarah responds with this piece of wisdom that I think we really need to pause and unpack. She looks at him and says, "We can't call dibs on ghosts. Love is not ownership."
That is the core philosophy of eternity right there. She isn't threatened by his past grief or his messy feelings. She is demanding that he be present in the now.
Love is not ownership. I mean, wow.
It is such a radical concept when applied to immortality. It forces humans to finally cure their possessiveness. You cannot monopolize another sentient being for a billion years. The only way relationships survive eternity is if you completely let go of the ego that demands to own someone else's past.
They truly settle into this profound, peaceful domestic routine after that. Sarah starts painting these massive canvases of theater wings and open-air markets, actively trying to make memory visible.
And Arthur keeps busy, too.
Yeah, Arthur cooks, he bakes fresh bread every morning, he repairs broken wooden chairs. They're intentionally building a quiet, deeply meaningful life together. But an eternity is a very, very long time.
It's literally forever.
Right. Which forces us to ask the ultimate question of this universe. What happens when you have literally done everything you want to do? We meet a character named Victor. He is this brilliant chess player Arthur meets under the sycamore trees. Victor has spent decades, maybe centuries, in the afterlife doing things like learning how to play every single musical instrument in existence.
Plus for fun.
Not to be famous, not to perform, but just to, as he puts it, finish all my sentences.
Right. And one day, Victor is playing the triangle, just a simple metal triangle. He strikes it with a wand, but he hits it wrong, producing this dull thud instead of a ring. He starts laughing.
Wait, over a thud?
Yeah, he laughs until he cries, and in that perfectly imperfect moment, he just knows. He's done. He's finished all his sentences. Later on, Lena's husband, Tomas, reaches the exact same conclusion. He leaves a note tucked into Lena's jar of paintbrushes that just says, "Had a lovely time. Water this for me."
It is so wildly casual, which feels crazy to us because in our biological world, death is almost always a tragedy. It's a theft. But here, leaving the simulation is a calm, deliberate, incredibly peaceful conclusion.
It's on their own terms.
Exactly. There is a public memorial wall where people go when they decide they are ready. They touch the wall, they leave a warm imprint of light that gently hums whenever someone remembers them, and they just log off. Yeah, no fanfare, no dramatic spectacle, no weeping crowds.
This raises an important question about the nature of eternity. The deepest, most profound grace of this afterlife simulation is that it isn't a trap. Even a flawless paradise becomes a prison if you aren't allowed to leave it.
That's a really good point. You'd go crazy.
True freedom, in the context of this narrative, means having the absolute, unassailable agency to end your own existence when you are deeply and completely satisfied with your journey.
So, how does Arthur handle watching his friends casually clock out of eternity? He actually starts teaching a seminar for newly arrived people, trying to help them adjust. He calls it Continuity for the Newly Startled.
That's a great name.
And one afternoon, a young medieval knight in his class raises his hand and asks Arthur if he ever thinks about leaving the simulation himself. And Arthur replies, yes, but not today. Today, there is bread.
That simple phrase perfectly encapsulates his entire character arc. He isn't rejecting the idea of the end. He knows the end is there whenever he wants it. But he is finding infinite, renewable value in small, deliberate daily choices.
The little things.
Yeah, the tactile act of baking bread, the smell of Sarah's oil paints, the quiet, unspoken company of his friends.
Which brings everything full circle beautifully. Think back to that terrifying, suffocating hospice room at the very beginning of our deep dive. Arthur's final thought as his 87-year-old body failed him was a desperate, fearful demand. I don't want to leave.
He was so scared.
It was born out of absolute terror and a dread of the void. But by the end of his journey in the afterlife simulation, he is standing in his sunny kitchen, listening to the kettle sing, watching Sarah mix paints on her palette. And he realizes that keeping hold of meaning isn't a frantic demand you scream into the dark. It is a daily practice.
It's an active choice.
Yes. His desire to stay is no longer a fearful plea for survival. It's a quiet promise he's keeping to himself and to the people he has chosen to love.
He was given an entire second world, a universe with the cheat codes turned on just to practice with, and he chose to use that time to practice being better. The primal fear of death was completely replaced by the quiet intentionality of living.
Exactly. And that leaves us with a thought I really want you to mull over as you go about the rest of your day. Imagine if you knew for an absolute fact that this exact afterlife simulation awaited you, a guaranteed infinite second life where you had the time, the safety, and the resources to heal every emotional wound, apologize for every mistake, and finish every single unfinished sentence you ever started.
A literal blank check for time.
Yeah. If you knew you had an eternity of flawless second chances waiting for you, how would it change the way you were living your first life right now? Would you take wilder, bigger risks because the pressure of consequence is finally off? Or would you finally stop rushing, stop stressing about the finish line, and just focus on baking the bread?